Greg Farrell is the president and CEO of Farrell Wealth and is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA SIPC insurance products offered through LPL Financial or its licensed affiliates. The opinions of Greg and his guests are merely opinions. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, and financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing.
Well, good morning. Show's Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and president of Farrell Wealth. It's a wealth management firm here locally here in Valparaiso, Indiana. We also have a number of clients all throughout the nation. We're a registered financial advisor, and the show is about money. We talk about money, about your money, hopefully save you some money. Thanks to Greg Kovach for being an engineer today, taking care of us today, as he always does here on Monday mornings at 10 a.m. Central Time. You can stream us at farrellwealth.com or also wvlp.org. We'd love to be able to have you streaming. Number of streamers are always on with us here every Monday. And as we talk the market, we talk investments, we talk value, we talk things that might be able to help you save some of that money, that those hard-earned dollars that you have that are so important. The show's about money, anything to do with money. We have a number of different podcasts as well. You can find all those podcasts at iTunes and just search Money Matters with Greg, and you'll find well over 80-some episodes that are up and running. We talk about everything from real estate transactions to mortgage rates to how to help your kids save some money as well and sort of put some dollars away and, you know, basically help you as a parent transfer on some good, solid financial advice. It is a financial literacy show, and that's why we like to be able to help teach here as much as we can. So it is Monday morning, June 11th, and we are right about June 12th, so right about into the middle of the month here as we go. I wanted to talk a little bit about the markets. We had our first sell-off in a long, long time in the NASDAQ last week. On Friday, it was down nearly 2% as many of these tech stocks took a hit, and they're down again today, another 1%. So many of the names you know that you've been following, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world, they've all been hit pretty hard. And is it really a buying opportunity, or is it just basically the end of the bull run here? And that's just really the question that's going on throughout the CNBCs and the Bloombergs of the world this morning as everyone's talking about what to do and how this looks. We've been talking about that on this show for a number of months now, just talking about valuations, talking about how things are not necessarily cheap out there, and also just trying to make sure that you are following a diversified portfolio strategy where you're trying to be able to own many of the different names or many different asset classes out there, but being diversified as much as possible for a long-term strategy. One of the things we always like to be able to talk about are some different things out there that you wouldn't necessarily know to think about. And one of those is today is we're talking about the Retirement Environment Index, which is an ability to be able to kind of discover and answer the complicated question of which state is best desirable or the most desirable for pre-retirees. We're going to go over that today at length and talk about which states out there in the Union of the United States of America are the best states to retire and why and how that index is basically put together. We're also going to talk a little bit about municipal bonds and what's out there in the world of munis. I want to be able to kind of review what's going on there out in the world and then also discuss MLPs. Master Limited Partnerships is what they're called. What are they and how do they work? We get a number of questions on Twitter. You can find us at Farrell Wealth on Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook for our Farrell Wealth page and also Money Matters with Greg. You'll see on that page as well. So any questions you'd like to be able to have answered on the show, you can also call in 219-476-9000. We'd love to hear from you and certainly would really enjoy having a conversation with some of the questions you might have. So that being said, what is the Retirement Environment Index and how does it basically help you kind of decide where to go? But what it is tries to answer that simple question of which state is most desirable for pre-retirees. And through this analysis, there is a there's an index that basically is used, and it's used from at LPL Research. You can find it at LPL on Twitter, at LPL Research. But basically, the index is it's a holistic ranking of the attractiveness of each U.S. state as a retirement destination. And this index really looks specifically at the 45 to 64-year-old pre-retirees and collectively assessing the strengths, the weaknesses of pre-retiree desirability of a state level. And rather than the city or a region, it's more so this is all based on states. So the 45 to 64-year-old subset of the baby boomer generation also includes some older members of Gen X, and states are evaluated on six key factors, each following different supporting metrics and overall desirability for retirement. Those six, when you list them out, are broad categories that really affect sort of that desirability. And each inside each category, four to six diverse subcategories kind of provide depth and balance to all of it. But let's just talk about the six. First of all, obviously financial. A state's fiscal health and financial health of a state's pre-retirees will likely impact individuals' ability to enjoy fulfilling retirement. Financial factors rank high across all surveys of pre-retiree preparedness. And the state's fiscal health and financial health is very important to pre-retirees. Healthcare, of course, access to and cost of healthcare are key determinants of retirement satisfaction. Along with financial factors, the quality of healthcare comprises really the top concern for most pre-retirees. Then you go into housing. The availability of affordable housing and the presence of nursing care or assisted living facilities are both vital, really, in the importance, but also can be a major expense in considering during retirement. We talked a lot about this on the show as far as the costs that are affiliated with healthcare and then also with housing. Then let's talk about the community as a whole. You talk about community as a quality of life and social factors which take into effect the crime rates. Certainly, it's changed to live on the south side of Chicago lately as far as retirement. One might be reconsidering that, for instance, is a good example. But the traffic patterns, the weather conditions are all kind of key determinants as far as happiness and satisfaction in retirement. Employment and education. The 20 years before retirement can really generate the highest rate of savings in, if fully employed. And employment may offer benefits beyond income, such as 401ks, pensions, and health insurance. So it's really important to pre-retirees as well. And then the final and sixth category is the personal habits. It would be wellness, but the personal habits and tendencies that impact health during those final years of employment. Poor habits of health are associated with premature death, poor quality of life, and increased healthcare cost, in addition to strains on state-provided resources. So those are the six: financial, healthcare, housing, community, quality of life, employment and education, and wellness. And for each subcategory, each state was really assigned a score based on the state's standing relative to national average in the distribution of the state-level data. And this subcategory scores were then weighted to reflect relative importance to get an overall final grade for each category. And letter grades makes it simple, right? We always do this in the NFL draft or any other sports drafts, right? You always give those letter grades. Letter grades for categories and subcategories are based on each state's percentile rankings for both subcourt category and category grades. So you get an A for a 90 to 100%, and that would put you in the top 10% of the states. You would get a B from a 70 to 90%, which is a huge range, but that would put you in the top 20%. And then a C is from all the way down to 30 to 70%, and that would be 40% of the states. So ABC, basically across the board. And you can find this report on our Facebook page. We'll have it there later. Again, it's member of FINRA, SIPC, LPL, financial research put this together, and it's client approved, and certainly you should check it out without a doubt, especially if you're in one of the bottom five states, which I'll list off in a minute. But let's talk about the regional trends. The retirement environment in each state is really unique, and some states are really differ vastly from neighboring states. Many regional trends are worth highlighting here. So one of the things you want to be able to mention is states in the Midwest scored the best on averages this year. The average was 15th place out of 51 states, and that was followed by the South. The West had the largest range of scores, with Wyoming taking number 5 and California coming in at number 50. Within each category, there were distinct regional trends among the four U.S. census regions, the Northeast, the South, the Midwest, and the West. And first of all, financial. The Midwest was the clear regional winner in the financial category for 2017. Metrics were in line with national average, except for cost of living, which is well below the national average, and just below that of the South. The Southeast, higher cost of living and tax burden pulled average financial scores lower for the region. And that is one thing you're going to see in this entire report is how taxes affect the rankings, without a doubt. You'll see many of these states, not to say you'll see why they receive F rankings in the financial side is because one of the main factors is taxes. That would be Fs for New York and an F for California, both 51st and 50th in overall rank, and the overall grade was an F for both. So, you know, not necessarily the best place to retire in regards to a number of different things, but first and foremost, financial side. But the healthcare side, the Northeast, really remains a stand-up and a standout in healthcare category, doing really well in most subcategories, and the Midwest sort of trails in this metric across all subcategories. Overall housing, the Midwest led, following closely by the South, based primarily really on housing affordability. It's much more affordable to be able to get a home or a condo or an apartment. The Southeast trails for the same reason, overall on housing. Community quality of life. The South comes in the top of the rankings with high scores across all metrics. The Northeast came in at the bottom this year due to higher crime and foreclosure rates. Employment and education. The Northeast stands out by far, followed by the West. The Northeast advantage is driven by higher college degree attainment rates and higher employment rates. The Midwest trailed across the board in regards to employment and education. And then wellness, the Northeast and the South were strong across all categories, whereas the Midwest followed behind, largely due to higher levels of obesity and a lower life expectancy for a 65-year-old. So let's go to the biggest movers of the region or the of the environment index. We're talking about the Retirement Environment Index here on Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and President of Farrell Wealth, and registered financial advisor, talking about some of the things that might help you in retirement and might want to consider. The new number one, and I won't go backwards, I'll just start off with number one. The new number one for this year is Nebraska. Nebraska moved several spots higher to take the number one spot this year, and in doing so, it dethroned Virginia, which had maintained the top spot for 2 years running. Now, Nebraska slipped one grade in housing, but improved scores in financial and community quality of life subcategories, which helped the state power higher in this overall rankings. Virginia, for its part, still ranked highly in most categories, though a slight downgrade on the financial category from A to a B pushed it to still respectable 7th place this year. Now, Rhode Island, it was a previous ranking of 36, it jumped to 26, and that moved really because they went from a B to an A in healthcare. That helped Rhode Island move 10 spots higher. The state scored really well across the board, but high rates of preventative health screenings and a lower rate of hospital discharges due to preventative issues were the main factors. The state also scored well in employment and education across the board, and that helped the overall rating. Let's go with Alaska. Look, Alaska was 50th last year. It was pretty bad, obviously really bad. And now they jumped to 39th. Improvements in financial and community quality of life scored helped move Alaska to these 11 spots. Low poverty and foreclosure rates helped quality of life scores, while an increase in median income helped as well to be able to move it on the financial side. A couple things in the Midwest trend here. Let's look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin was previously ranked 26. It jumps to 16. Had marginal declines in financial, healthcare, and community quality. They went to an overall score of an A in 2015 to a C in 2016. Now, the state maintained an overall C rating for 2017, but a bounce back in healthcare and quality of life certainly and helped. Declining poverty, foreclosure, crime levels all helped move the needle for community quality of life for Wisconsin. Washington, D.C., previous ranking was 16th, and now it drops all the way to 30th. It has the largest drop in rankings year over year, driven primarily by a decline in the financial score. This is an increase in cost of living, where the district already ranks second highest in the state, and then coupled with low scores in housing quality of life, hurt by the district's 2017 ranking. On the plus side, though, Washington, D.C. does continue to rate higher in healthcare and unemployment and education categories across the board. Let's go New York. New York, I mentioned earlier, was pretty bad. Now it was 49th last year. Now it's even worse at 51st. And this low financial community quality of life and the housing scores combined with a slight drop in healthcare basically fell to the bottom of this year's ranking. California, which was at the bottom last year, managed to move up one spot higher to slightly increase because of its housing score. So that's our report on overall financial, you know, retirement index. If you're living in the state of Indiana, I bet you're wanting to know where we are. We are 31st in overall ranking. We received C's across the board, basically, which is we can do better, people. We can do better. We need to be able to do better at that. But we got our overall ranking was a C. Our financial was a C. Our healthcare was a C. Our housing was a C. Our community quality of life is a D, and I would assume that that would be a lot of the obesity situation, and wellness was a D. So that would really, those really hurt us. We are one spot behind West Virginia, and so we can do better than that. Who, by the way, West Virginia got an F for wellness, so it's pretty bad. Texas and healthcare both received an F. Let's talk about some of the A's. Missouri received an A for housing. Virginia received an A for community quality of life. Utah received an A for wellness. New Hampshire received an A for employment and education. Nebraska received an A for quality of life, community quality of life. Massachusetts was an A for healthcare. Texas was an A for financial. So along with South Dakota, Wyoming, Tennessee, and Nebraska were all A's on the financial side. So interesting to see some of these things and how we all shape up and how things look. Again, that is the United States overall retirement environment index grade for 2017. So again, you can find that report on our Facebook page. Just go to Farrell Wealth on Facebook and you can see us there and find that report. The show's Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and president of Farrell Wealth. We talk money on this show. And we'd like to be able to sort of bring to you some things that might be a little different and not necessarily conversations that you can find throughout the mainstream media and whatnot. So that's why I wanted to be able to bring you a retirement index like that. I thought it was really interesting to see kind of where these states match up. And we'll see. We'll keep you abreast here as a year by year as how these things go. It was really fun reading it last year and then also seeing where we are today. Really quickly, wanted to talk about municipalities and municipals on the menu. Municipal bonds really have performed well in 2017, and they're sort of mirroring the direction of treasury bonds overall. By the way, I had a question, actually, going back to a question that came over here on Twitter, just backing up a little, Illinois was asked about. So Illinois was a D. They received an overall rank of 35th. behind Louisiana at 34 and behind Indiana at 33. So 2015 ranking was 24th for Illinois. 2016 ranking was 39th. And then they did creep up four spots to be 35th. They basically received a D in financial, mainly because of the taxes overall, but then also C's across the board for everything. So thanks for the contributing there. And I just want to be able to back up on that as far as answering that question. So back to municipals. Real quick, municipalities really have improved as far as the municipal investments. Valuations lately have been really stretched. And there's been a manageable supply and a heavy coupon reinvestment during really the summer months that may sort of stabilize all of this in the near term. I just wanted to be able to mention some things that are coming up here in the municipal world. And these are opportunities for you to be able to invest in different municipalities throughout the nation, whether they be city, state, or federal. Many of them are tax-exempt on all three. Some are tax-exempt on two, and some are tax-exempt on just on one level. But with everything going on in Puerto Rico and with their issuance of default and the credit issues that are in Puerto Rico and certainly and more recently in Illinois, I really wanted to be able to talk about what's going on in the muni world for investment and basically making sure that if you are investing in looking for that opportunity to get tax-free yield, that you're investing in the right places. So as of 2016, it kind of felt like it was all over. The same thing was going to happen all over again. When municipals sold off in the second half of the year in 2016, really similar to 2016, there were returns coming into the 2017 numbers that sort of made you really look back and look pretty pretty much the same. It looked like history was repeating itself. You saw stretch valuations. You saw higher prices. And really, we just want to be able to mention we're forecasting a more gradual increase to supply to close 2017 as opposed to 2016. So when you talk about the delay in the political program centered on taxation, the infrastructure spending, this may relieve some of the headwinds that are really which were very prevalent in 2016. And even though you have credit issues, like I said, in Puerto Rico and Illinois, these all seem to be really isolated situations. So despite the higher prices year to date, I really want to continue to favor high quality municipals as an offer to a tax advantage way to diversify portfolios and really very little correlation to stocks and high risk bonds. So far, how's the year been? It's been pretty solid. The Bloomberg Barclays Municipal Bond Index posted a total return of 1.5% in May and a 4.4% year to date. Now, remember, this is a taxable, tax-free return. So this is much improved from the sell-off that occurred in late 2016 when the index lost 3.7% in November. It was the worst month since September 2008, and underperforming Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Bond Index it underperformed the bond index by 1%. Now, although performance has been better and the similarities in these returns to 2016 are really worth mentioning, that's why I bring them up, it's really important to realize that the technical setup then was much different. Last year, municipals experienced 56 weeks of cash inflows prior to October 2016, resulting in greater demand. This year, inflows have been positive but really muted, resulting in less overbought conditions. And this would really provide more stability to the market. Relative valuations, like I mentioned, are mixed. Municipal bond investors often pay a higher price to receive less yield for an added benefit of tax-free income that they receive. Now, generally, municipal bond prices are below comparable taxable bond prices overall, and municipal bonds are really said to be cheap. Another way to compare relative value to this is really to look at the ratio of the municipal bond yields to treasury bond yields across the board. historically, when you look at Bloomberg pricing data, a 10-year ratio above 85% and a 30-year ratio above 95% is thought to represent good value. Currently, the 10-year ratio is 8% above the historic average. But the more expensive, than the 5-year average of 96.2%. So the 30-year ratio is now at 97%, also above its historic level, but expensive compared to the 5-year average of 102%. And this may differ, obviously, based on data. But in addition to ratios that show municipals are slightly expensive, absolute yields have been coming down as well. And the AAA Blue benchmark 10-year index, which measures characteristics for highly rated AAA municipal bonds, now yields 1.85, which is well below the multi-high year yield of 2.57. So let's look at supply. The supply of new bonds priced in the primary market also affects the relative value of municipals. And May's issuance was $13.2 billion, which was higher than the 10-year monthly average of $11 billion. But this also caused very little weakness in the markets. So you'll start looking at the inflows and the actual inventory, which is really important with municipals. If you go to buy a bond to buy, typically people overpay. So with the seasonally high municipal supply months of March through May behind us, the monthly cash flows in and out of municipal bonds will be really important. And June is a heavy coupon reinvestment period. So when many interest rate payments are received or reinvested back in the market, this could all just kind of keep prices in check. High cash inflows will lead to greater demand, which in turn is going to drive yields lower. And also, all else being equal, the supply picture turning more favorable and the potential for fund inflows to remain positive, prices should remain pretty stable. So really, in conclusion, in regards to municipal bonds, investment grade and high yield municipals are off to a good start for 2017. And moving forward, we really don't expect a repeat of 2016's second half sell-off as supply is expected to be lighter through the summer months. Overall, tax-free yields relative to taxable U.S. Treasuries are lower than in late 2016, with proposed tax cuts, increased infrastructure spending potentially pushed back to 2018. We're really forecasting a more stable year end for municipals in 2017. So we remain neutral to overweight on municipal high yield as a longer maturity profile can be volatile, and rising rate environments can affect overall rates. Obviously, you want to be able to make sure you're watching where you're investing, whether you're investing in Puerto Rico and Illinois or some of these states that are more volatile, that you're getting the yield that you deserve, because they could easily default. So always want to make sure you're investing wisely when it comes to that. So that's our municipal report. We're going to come back here after a quick break and talk about master limited partnerships. What are MLPs and how they might actually help your portfolio get some extra juice as far as yield and why people invest in them. So we're going to talk about that in a second. It's 10:30 here. We're taking a quick break. It shows Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and president of Farrell Wealth. We talk money here. It's financial literacy. We're excited to have you with us. Thanks for all the streaming today and the viewing. Excited to be able to have you guys on board and help you are having a happy Monday. And if we leave at, after this break, if you leave us for whatever reason, I hope you have a great week. We'll be back in a bit. Thanks. Thank you, JT. That's a great song. Thank you, Greg Kovach, for pulling that out, pulling out all the stops here. So we got a little James Taylor here, Money, Money, Money. The show's Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and president of Farrell Wealth. It's a wealth management firm here that's local here to Valparaiso, but also a number of clients throughout a number of states throughout the nation. And just love being able to help people on a daily basis. And that's why we started this show, is really to be able to sort of give you an idea and maybe an education into some of the things that are out there that you might not necessarily know about. And if we can help you out in any way, certainly that's what our mission is, to be able to sort of give you an education and add some value to you and your family. Hopefully save you some money down the line, maybe make you some money along the way. Certainly that's the plan. So wanted to talk today. We went over what the retirement index for a number of states in the nation. I thought it was really interesting to be able to show where a lot of states out there rank. And then wanted to we talked a little bit about the municipal bond market. We have a stock market today that is the NASDAQ, and many of the tech stocks across the world are being ravaged. Lately, we were down 2% on Friday, down another 1% today. So the leadership that has been the tech world is certainly being challenged here in the last couple days here. And so want to be talking about that. But also wanted to bring up today something about in regards to oil. Oil's been very volatile in the last few weeks. We obviously have had the holiday season with in this nation, with Memorial Day weekend, which is always a big day for many of us to travel. The millions of us that get the head to the roads and look to visit family and enjoy certainly the holiday weekend. It does affect our gas prices. Typically, that's usually at the high side of the summer, and then from there off we sell, sort of sell off. And that is the case recently. Now, we've been very volatile in between a $44 a barrel of Brent crude all the way up to about $52, and then today we're selling off around $47. So really, we were talking about this in the show a little while ago about the range, and so far we've been dead right on where it's going. And the fact that we're sort of in this range for a while. But one of the things that most people don't realize or don't know about is what's called a master limited partnership. Now, this is also from a report that comes from a weekly market commentary. You can get it on our website at Feral Wealth from LPL Research. They do a great job and really explain what an MLP is. I'm not recommending in any way one MLP or another, and obviously everybody's financial situation is necessary that you make sure that you are investing wisely and researching all things. But MLPs really can provide investors with exposure to sort of a niche of different aspect of energy and the overall production chain. MLPs are sensitive to a number of factors, including the prices of oil, prices of natural gas, the interest rates, and the overall performance of the stock market. And really, the performance of MLPs does not seem very connected to any of them at times. So despite the poor performance year to date, MLPs may seem pretty well positioned to go forward. And that's why I want to be able to talk about it as we look at overall diversified portfolios and make sure that you are investing wisely. Master limited partnerships, they really appear to sort of be this natural way to invest in the changing energy landscape, and many people are talking about them because they exclusively are focused on energy infrastructure in the United States and Canada, and North American energy production really has become a dominant factor in the price of oil and the North American drive to be energy independent. But the pricing and the performance of MLPs really can be extremely complicated. And this is influenced by a number of factors, such as the price of oil and gas, the interest rates, the movement of the equity markets overall. Like we mentioned, and MLPs are really influenced by a degree of success of each individual partnership, because it is a partnership in the same way that traditional stocks performance are determined by both market and individual factors. Really, recent performance overall as the sector may still represent a good long-term investment option. But let's just go back and back up a little. What is an MLP? MLPs are technically partnership interests that issue units instead of shares. And that often is a trade on a national stock exchange. And these partnerships are legal entities that, by definition, have a pass-through tax structure and do not pay federal or state income tax. Now, in order to qualify for this treatment, the partnership must generate more than 90% of its income in qualifying income. And the definition of qualifying income has really changed over the years. It's really been largely limited to payments related to natural resources, commodities, and real estate. In practice, this really means that MLPs are typically involved in transportation, storage of oil, and natural gas. But unlike real estate investment trusts, which are REITs, MLPs are only required to pay out available capital. This is, basically by definition, where REITs are required to pay out 90% of income received overall, and REITs are a real estate investment trust. So because the revenue of an MLP is determined by the amount of oil or gas flowing through the pipeline, not the price of that commodity, MLPs are often referred to as energy toll roads. And they're required to pay most of their income, and that income is exempt from income tax. Now, furthermore, the actual distribution of from the MLP is frequently characterized as return of capital as opposed to income. So the unit holder does really not pay income tax at the time of distribution. MLPs historically have higher yields than dividend yields on the broad stock market averages. Or even higher yield than investment grade bonds overall. Now, there is much more risk in this situation, and there's a number of factors that you want to be able to consider. But MLPs may really be a potential play for investors seeking quarterly distributions, much like REITs. And the tax component does present an element of uncertainty to MLP pricing. As a function of the tax code, their status really could be removed by Congress. So, in addition to lower personal, corporate, and income tax, they may make MLPs look less attractive. So we'll see. But in the meantime, it's business as usual. The change in energy fortunes really have changed immensely in the last, it seems like it's changing exponentially and quicker as we move along. But the United States is heavily dependent on imported oil, with much of the oil coming from the Middle East. In 1981, after the two major oil supply shocks of the 1970s, Congress created a concept of the MLP to really encourage private capital investment in U.S. energy production. And interest in MLPs and their tax-advantaged nature grew substantially over those years until Congress clarified the rules in order to limit their use to oil and gas-related companies overall. It was really the development of drilling technologies, which notably the hydrofracking or the fracking, that led to sustained interest in MLPs. So really, due to the changes in the drilling technology, North America is largely energy self-sufficient, and the United States has all the natural gas and coal it needs, quite possibly for generations. So due to the increased domestic oil production, the U.S. only imports about 25% of its oil, and approximately 45% comes from Canada and Mexico. And these are countries where U.S.-based MLPs help facilitate all this movement of energy. The prospective future of the MLPs was enhanced after the 2016 election, with oil and gas production increasing significantly during the past 5 years, despite the skepticism about safety of fracking from the Obama administration and a number of state governments. The Trump administration promised to really be much more energy friendly, with promises to roll back regulations and improve permits for additional energy development. Now, according to Bloomberg, there is an estimated that there is about $50 billion in energy projects waiting permits. Thus far, the Trump administration has been unable to speed up this process or deal with its backing or this backlog. One reason for the delay is that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commissioner, the main regulatory body for energy infrastructure, only has two of its five commissioners seated right now, and one of those two announced that she would not stay on after her term expires this June. So really viewing the current rebalancing of oil supply and demand in a very positive for domestic energy production and MLPs going forward. So reduction in supply from OPEC has been met with increased production in North America, and this really should benefit Canadian and U.S. MLPs, and even those that connect with Mexico as well. So what moves an MLP? What makes the market move in MLPs? Investing in MLPs should really be pretty straightforward, but there are a number of areas of confusion. Many factors drive MLPs' performance, and these different factors sort of dominate at different times. How much an MLP's index performance can be attributed to different factors overall. The most consistent factor determining MLP performance is still the broad equity market, as measured here by as measured by the S&P 500. The price of oil matters most to MLP performance when oil is the most volatile, such as peaks in the mid 2008. And the near record of the price collapse in 2016, you see sort of surprising is how seldom interest rates are a major factor in MLPs. Many people talk about MLPs and the interest rates and the movement. You hear it quite often, but really the changes in the 10-year treasury bond are seldom the primary driver of MLP returns. And overall, we really look to the yield to determine the MLPs are attractive as far as valuation. And at current levels, MLP yields can be attractive to investors, assuming stable oil prices. And that's basically what we've had here for a number of months, is pretty stable range of oil prices. So the performance of MLPs has really been disappointing, even as the stock prices have increased. Really believe that a lot of this is due to the decline in oil prices for the year. The oil prices really do not have to rise for MLPs to appear attractive. They just need to be stable. And the strong fundamental backdrop of MLPs with the increased North American production and what is likely to be an easier regulatory environment going forward, kind of combined with the attractive valuations, you really have to say that MLPs have a role in a diversified investment portfolio, and it might be something to seriously consider. Now, investing in MLPs involves additional risk as compared with risk in investing in common stock, including risk related to cash flow dilution, voting rights, taxable situations. Many MLPs give out a 1099 or a K-1 depending on how they are invested. And these are all things to consider when you're investing with an MLP or investing in real estate trust with special risk. So just want to be able to mention that because it is a very narrow focus. They are very narrow focusly. They are very narrowly focused in regards to what they invest in. But looking for value out there is really what we're trying to find as much as we can, with everything being so overpriced in the stock market. Just want to be able to mention how MLPs might be something you want to look into. So master limited partnerships overall are, in our opinion, something to at least consider for a diversified portfolio. This show's Money Matters with Greg. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and President of Farrell Wealth. It's a wealth management firm helping a number of high net worth clients and individuals and families and companies out with their wealth, managing, helping, and advising them with a number of different things, everything from 401k retirement plans all the way to insurance and overall investments. We talk a lot of those things that we talk with clients we talk about on this show. And that's why we started the show a number of years ago, to really sort of help you educate yourself and learn a little bit more about some of the things out there that we find fascinating and interesting. Obviously, we love talking the financial world. Not everybody does. But if you want to be able to grab a couple nuggets of information, we feel like this show is a great place for you to be able to start. You can find us on iTunes through searching Money Matters with Greg on iTunes, and you can find well over 80 shows that we've produced and had made. You can also find us in our blog. Money Matters with Greg blog is on Farrell Wealth, and many of the ideas that we talk about in the show are from that blog, and I'd like to be able to bring some of those ideas here to you on the radio. It is 103.1 FM WVLP. and a community radio station here in Valpo, and we love what they do here. And if you're wanting to be able to participate, please contact the station directly at 219-476-9000. For advertising on this show or other shows, the lineups are great. There's a great, there's some really high quality, interesting people on a number of different shows that are available here at WVLP. I highly recommend you you tune in, you stream at WVLP.org, and you fall in love with some other shows that are out here. But in the meantime, we're here to make you some money and hopefully doing just that. Overall, I wanted to talk about the last 10 minutes of the show. This is actually on our blog, and this is just a recent blog post that we posted. It was how to engage your young kids in learning about money at a young age. I have kids, and it is certainly an ongoing process for all of us as parents to make sure that we are educating our children in regards to money, because it does affect so many things. I always say, money isn't everything, but it sure does put down a really nice down payment on happiness. It's something to think about all the time. And kids, especially nowadays with the college debt that's going on, as far as wanting things versus needing things, all these different things that come about in regards to a daily exercise. And I wrote a blog, the blog that just came out just recently. You can find it on farrellwealth.com and certainly get a copy of it. But if you think about the early days in life, and you know, really when it seemed like everything in the candy aisle was free, if you begged your parents hard enough, now this sort of fleeting thought was given to the expenses of a vacation or a copay cost at a doctor. I mean, these things are all been exponentially growing over the years. And really, you know, we went from the candy aisle where everything was free to now, you know, these expenses that we have to deal with as an adult. And there's really something beautifully unburdened in a way in which children experience the world. I mean, they're recklessly present and innocently ambivalent would be the best way I could put it. Teaching your children lessons about money from a young age now won't crush that. What it will do is set them up on a path of future financial successes with enduring financial concepts. Children's monetary habits are formed as young as age 7, according to a report published by the University of Cambridge researchers. And that means your children are going and growing they're going to learn about how to treat their money from someone. And it's better for that person to be you so you can guide the experience and activities. That's what we've always said, you know, let us give you the information as parents, and then we'll help you with it and disseminate it and give you the best, hopefully the best decision-making process versus getting your information from somewhere else that's wrong. We'll at least tell you what the information is and we'll talk about it. So some of the things that you can do and really engaging your young kids and learning about money are the following. One of them is take them on errands with you. Regardless if it's a farmer's market or a visit to the bank, take your children with you. Yes, I know it's easier to go without them at times. I totally understand that. But these shopping experiences really teach them how to behave in a monetary transaction, in a daily transaction form. Engaging the children rather than dragging them along is really the goal. So make a list at the grocery store and let them hold it. Cross things off as an example of how to avoid impulse buying. If they're old enough, ask them to read the prices on comparative items, like two boxes of cereal, and ask them which one is cheaper. Just simple things that can really help you engage your child. Next is let them pay. Look, a lecture on how much things cost does little in comparison to experience. When your child wants to spend their birthday or allowance money or something on something that, you know, on something that they want and then they really feel as they need, and really you need to help them first determine how much they want to spend compared to what they want. Help them pull out the correct amount of change from their money container and let your child physically give the cash to the cashier. They'll quickly understand how when you want something, you have to pay for it with hard-earned money, right? So it's actual money that's there, not just a credit card. And there's something to be said for seeing that money go across the table and never come back. You really want to be able to make sure that there's some sort of value there and some sort of lesson as well. Another recommendation would be using a clear container for savings. I've done this in the past and certainly have not had the results I've wanted in regards to piggy banks. I finally decided they're really cute, but a clear container allows kids to actually see the savings grow as the jar fills. When they deposit money, I used to actually, fill up a jar that was clear and you look at it one way and it looks pretty empty. And if you fluff up the dollars that are in there, it looks a lot better. So, versus basically a painted vessel that you can't see anything in. When they deposit money into the jar, discuss how much they added and congratulate them on adding their savings. And keep your own jar close by and put extra change into it. And children are natural imitators, and they'll want to keep on putting money into their jar just like you. And then the three adages of spend, save, and give. When we were parents, we set up a spend piggy bank, a save piggy bank, and a give piggy bank. And initially, we had our kids put in a third, a third, a third, and then we would have a meeting with them about their favorite charities and where this money should go. That has been something that has been I highly recommend and has been worthwhile in a number of different ways. I mean, we've invested in charities everywhere from our 5-year-old daughter was really into giraffes. We found a giraffe refuge in Africa I didn't even know existed and gave them money that year. Every year is different. But money isn't meant just to be saved. And with young children, you really have the opportunity to instill in them that ethos of giving early on. You know, an easy way to do this is really to get three large clear jars and label them, one for spending, one for saving, one for giving, and allow your child to choose a cause that they care about and donate their give money to. And it's a great conversation because you never know what's coming. And so as they get older especially, it's really interesting to see where the money goes. But you really want to let them see their money doing good if possible. So, for example, if the child decides to donate they're giving money to a local animal shelter, take a trip to the facility, see the animals. You could also incorporate concepts of giving time to this activity as well. Time is money, and you can teach that as well. But you develop a system that works for you and your family, and that's really what it's all about. So I always like to mention the time because many of us volunteer, and we don't really put a dollar number on our volunteer time. You should do that too. And if you can even put an IOU basically a bill into your giving jar showing the hours that you've given to a charity as well. And it sort of helps really put it into perspective as to how much time you are giving towards a certain cause and also makes you appreciate everything that you're doing for that cause. When you pull out all your dollars from that jar and you have all these notes to yourself about the hours you've given, it really is powerful. The last way to engage your young kids in learning how about money at a young age is to set a goal. We always talk on this show about make a plan, work the plan, just like my dad used to tell me when I was a kid. And a lot of that goes along with setting a goal. Look, invite your children or your child really to just set a goal of something that they want. So, you know, if it's a trip to Chuck E. Cheese's, a new toy, or a video game, but look up the price and create a fun chart to really kind of keep track of how much they've saved towards that goal. You can do the stereotypical thermometer that most charities do. And start adding the red ink to the made up thermometer. But for example, if they want a new doll, create a chart and with a picture of a doll in it, and they have the doll colored up to the lines marked off with certain percentages so they can see how much they've saved towards their goal. Once the total's been reached, they'll take the child to go buy the item with their money and have them hand it over to the sales clerk. This is a valuable exercise in learning how to wait to buy something that you want. So teaching children about money isn't always going to be easy, but it certainly will be worthwhile. Look, a strong, knowledgeable foundation about money means a step in the right direction towards financial security as an adult. So I highly recommend you engage your kids as much as possible. This is just some ideas I thought I might want to be able to mention. This all comes from familyeducation.com. You can find out there. There's also a great article in Wall Street Journal about the smart way to teach children about money. You can also look at bankrate.com. This is also another source this came from, and also parents.com. So some really nice sources for you out there. Just trying to help out as a parent as well, is that you might be able to share with your kids. I'm Greg Farrell, CEO and president of Farrell Wealth. It's a wealth management firm here locally in Valpo. And we help clients and businesses with a number of the different financial conversations and issues and advising them on different things out there in the world. And that's why we started this show, is really to help you as well, to teach, to give some advice on some of the things that are out there as far as financial literacy. And we're flattered to be able to have the opportunity here at WVLP 103.1 FM to be able to run this show on Mondays at 10 o'clock and Fridays, the replay at noon. So that is Central Time, so please tune in. You can also find us on iTunes for all the different podcasts that we have. Just search out Money Matters with Greg. And find us there. Also on Twitter, Facebook, you name it, we're here. Call the station if you want to advertise and be a part of the show, 219-476-9000. And that's about it. I want to be able to wish everybody a very, very good week. I hope everybody stays cool. We're going to have some time off here with the holidays coming up on the show, but we'll be back as time goes on. In the meantime, find us on iTunes and download our shows as much as you like, and listen early and listen often. So hope everybody's great. Thanks to Greg Kovach again for running the show here as engineer. And I want to thank everybody for the opportunity, and hope you have a fantastic week, and be profitable. Bye.
Greg Farrell is the president, CEO of Farrell Wealth, and is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC insurance products offered through LPL Financial or its licensed affiliates. The opinions of Greg and his guests are merely opinions. All individuals should get their proper advice investing and managing their personal finances. Money, get back.